Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore, and thanks for tuning in. Today we are listening to Sins of Our Fathers, a novel by Sean Lawrence Otto, published in 2014 by Milkweed Editions.
Eagle had done the combination on the safe at their request, but when he was finished, Olson told him to step away and not turn the lever. He backed up and got to his feet, and Olson knelt down and stretched on a pair of latex gloves.
"Sir," he said, "is there anything I should know about the safe? Any trip mechanisms or any firearms in there?" "No, it's just my papers and some cash for the business."
Olson glanced up at Richardson and placed his hand on the lever. Eagle watched him pause, close his eyes for a moment, and pull the safe door open. He inspected the inside, then looked up at Richardson and Flatabow.
"Only papers, like he said. No cash, though."
This struck Eagle as wrong. He was sure he had put $800 in there to pay the Ricers. He wondered if he had left it in his jeans in his rush to get ready for the ceremony.
"What's in the baggie?" Richardson asked.
Olson pulled the baggie out and sniffed it.
"Tobacco. It says organic Indian tobacco on the label."
Eagle looked at Richardson and lifted his hands in an expression of incredulity.
"Why is it in the safe?" asked Richardson.
"It's sacred. I'm a pipe carrier."
Richardson nodded, skeptically turning over a tiny piece of gum in his cheek. Flatabow lifted the Ziploc bag.
"There's wild rice in the horse manure," he said.
Richardson stepped up to examine it. He squeezed the bottom.
"Keep searching," he said. "The money's here somewhere."
Flatabow nodded and lowered the sack. Agent Olson stood. Eagle spoke up again.
"Can I just ask you gentlemen how horse manure equals probable cause?"
Richardson looked at him as if he might be offended, but his face was inscrutable. Then he inhaled and seemed to come to a sudden decision.
"Last night someone broke into the North Lake Bank. Same bank, you might remember, that just had a fire. The officer out on the porch was shot by a fleeing suspect after that incident."
Eagle swallowed. He knew this was dangerous territory. Law enforcement had spent the better part of the week trying to get information out of anybody and everybody on the reservation. He had never seen them so on edge. Whoever it was couldn't crack the main safe, but they cut the night depository open and got away with $117,000 in a bank cash transfer, Richardson continued. Fortunately, they all had recorded serial numbers. He seemed to be studying Eagle's reaction to this.
"But what could I have possibly had to do with that?" Eagle asked.
"We got a phone tip. Someone saw your vehicle. A wild rice truck."
Eagle's mind leaped to J.W.
"Who saw it?" he asked.
"That's not important at this point."
"John White? Was that your tipster? The banker with the gambling problem?"
Eagle could imagine J.W. stealing the money and trying to pin it on him.
"I can't say," said Richardson.
But the name seemed like new information to him. Eagle pressed his advantage.
"Last night he could have been driving that vehicle without my permission. I was at a public ceremony in front of hundreds of people, being honored by the whole community. And then I was here at home with my son. When did this burglary happen?"
Jacob was shoved into the room by Grossman, who followed with Barden.
"Quit pushing me!"
"Shut it,"
Grossman said, pointing toward him aggressively.
"Deputy, what's going on?"
Agent Richardson asked, his voice filled with irritation.
"This kid has a long history of trouble."
"Now just a minute," objected Eagle.
But Grossman held up a hand to silence him, and with the other, he held up a bundle of $20 bills.
"I found this in front of the house."
"It wasn't in front of the house. It was out on the road,"
Jacob yelled.
"The road in front of the house," Grossman clarified. But his tone was patronizing, and his teeth were clenching his gum.
Richardson took the money. He glanced at Olson, and Eagle saw Olson step closer to him.
"Look, I didn't have anything to do with this," Eagle said.
He saw Barden nod to Grossman, and Grossman step over to block the door, legs wide, chewing his gum.
Oh, come on. I'm telling you, I have no idea where that came from. And if somebody actually saw the vehicle, as you claim it, it would have been John White who was driving it.
Richardson took out a list of serial numbers from his shirt pocket. He glanced at Eagle, then scanned the list against the top bill in the packet. He looked up at Barton.
Arrest him.
This is
Jacob yelled.
He didn't do anything!
Grossman and Barton moved in on Eagle, crowding him toward the desk.
I've never seen that money, he said. I've never seen it.
He pointed at Grossman.
For all we know, he could have dropped it there. He harasses our community all the time, and he has it in for my son.
Grossman stepped up behind Eagle, enveloping him in a cloud of body odor. He exhaled through his nose, and Eagle could smell his spearmint gum over the acridity as Grossman wrenched his arms firmly behind him and closed a pair of cool metal handcuffs around his wrists, clicking them a notch tighter than necessary.
You know what they say, he said low in Eagle's ear. Nut doesn't fall far from the tree.
Deputy Barden stepped up in front of him.
Look at me, Mr. Eagle, he said. You have the right to remain silent.
It's all right, son, Eagle said to Jacob,
wanting to protect him from the idea that his father might have done something this wrong.
This is all a mistake. We'll figure it out. I want you to go tell your aunt.
Grossman snugged the handcuffs even tighter and wrenched Eagle's arms painfully together behind him.
Listen to the man, he said.
Then Eagle felt him step back as Barden finished reading him his rights. But as he did, Grossman leaned over his desk and looked out through the blinds.
Hang on, Dan, he said.
And then, what the hell?
Richardson moved in front of Eagle and looked out as well. Eagle stepped back to make room, nearly tripping on Grossman, and looked out through the blinds. Smoke was billowing out of the windows of J.W.'s old blue trailer home, rising in gray tufts through the orange leaves. Chapter 34. Green and yellow flames shot high from all four stovetop burners, sending up smoke and sparks. The trailer was filling with a noxious cloud from the blackening curls of cash. J.W. stripped bands off the bundles in his hand and crumpled more bills to fuel the fire. He had opened the windows and the roof vent to let the smoke out and attract attention. He reached into the trash can liner and pulled out two more handfuls of cash bundles and threw them full onto the flames like small logs. He coughed at the dappled cloud of smoke and ash that rose up and spread across the ceiling. He ducked to look up at Eagle's porch from the window over the kitchen sink, catching a breath of fresh air. He wondered how long it would take before they noticed. He grabbed the dish towel and ran it under the tap as the cash burned hot and crackling next to him, then wrung it out and held it over his face. Grossman followed Richardson and the other officers onto the porch. Barden stepped out with Eagle.
That's John White's place, said Flottebeau.
Who? Said Richardson, seeming surprised.
John White. He's the president of the bank, replied Grossman.
Well, get the hell down there, Richardson ordered. What the hell is the bank president doing in the trailer? What else have I not been told?
Grossman began jogging down the walk. Smoke was pouring from the trailer's open windows and a vent on the roof. He wondered if J.W. was really inside. Flottebeau jogged up beside him. They ran across the grass and up to the trailer home. Grossman stepped up the wooden stairs, his bravado returning, and pounded on the aluminum door.
J.W., you in there?
There was no answer, but they could hear someone coughing and choking.
This isn't right, he said. You sure this is John White's place? Not some meth lab?
Yeah, said Flottebeau, his face red. I've been here before.
Grossman was still skeptical, but he pounded again.
J.W., we know you're in there. Come on out.
They could hear flames crackling just inside and more coughing. Grossman unsnapped his holster and drew his gun. He thumbed the safety catch off and stood beside the door, his back to the trailer wall and his gun pointing at the sky. His heart was racing.
You'll have to come get me,
they heard from inside, followed by more hacking. Grossman nodded to Flottebeau, who also drew his gun. He took a breath as if preparing to jump into a lake, feeling suddenly shaky with adrenaline. Then he whipped the door open. A cloud of hot smoke engulfed him. Grossman stepped up into the hot interior, and through the smoke he saw J.W. covering his face with a towel and feeding bundles of cash onto a fire on the stovetop.
"Hold it!" he yelled, his gun aimed at J.W.
J.W. glanced at him and kept going. Grossman rushed him and they crashed onto the floor, the bundles scattering across the floor around them. Grossman was on top of him in the smoke, and J.W. was pawing at him like a wild animal. Grossman was choking, his eyes burning. He raised his gun and hit J.W. in the head with the side of the barrel. J.W. yelled in pain, and his arms bent up over his face to protect himself.
"All right,"
he barked, coughing desperately.
"Get off me!"
Grossman saw that he had opened a gash over J.W.'s left eyebrow.
"J.W., what the f-?"
he yelled. But then smoke filled his lungs and he started to cough and choke as he gasped in even more. His head was spinning. J.W. seemed to recognize that Grossman was in trouble.
"Get out! I'll follow," he said.
Grossman nodded, his eyes burning. He crawled off J.W. and headed for the door, his arms shaking, his eyes raining. Somehow he managed to look back and make sure J.W. was following. Jacob stood on the porch with his dad, Olson, Barden, and Richardson.
"Stay here, son," Eagle said, eyeing the trailer.
They watched as Grossman, coughing, fell out of it. A moment later, J.W. followed, then stumbled shakily to his feet, holding a sagging dish towel. Flatabow trained his gun on him, and he raised his hands in submission. Jacob was dumbfounded. This was impossible. J.W. had made him return the cigars. He was his friend. Something was wrong. Grossman stumbled to his feet, lost his balance, then stood again. He put his hands on his knees for a moment and hacked deeply, silver bands of snot and saliva streaming from his nose and mouth. Flatabow got J.W. to place his hands on the trailer wall, then holstered his gun and began to frisk him. Barden's handheld squawked, and Grossman's voice came raspy over the radio.
"We got it! We got the money!" he gasped.
A sense of confusion and betrayal rose in Jacob. He had seen J.W. come out of the trailer with his own eyes. J.W. had stolen the money.
"Whole bag of it," rasped Grossman. "He was burning it on the stove."
He wiped a stream of snot from his face.
10-4, said Richardson. He was standing beside Jacob. "Is it still burning?"
"Just what's on the stove. I gotta go back in and put it out,"
replied Grossman, turning back to the door. But then Flatabow said something to him, and Grossman nodded and went to handcuff J.W., while Flatabow took a deep breath and stepped up into the trailer. Then Jacob heard the hollow metal whoosh of a fire extinguisher, and the smoke began to slow.
"The son of a b-," said Eagle, his hands still cuffed behind his back. He looked at Jacob. "I'm sorry I exposed you to him, son. I should have known better."
"But he was at the Eagle Feather ceremony with Aunt Mona."
"They found the money in his trailer, son. This whole thing was his doing."
"I guess the FBI had it wrong," said Deputy Barden. He glanced at Richardson, who nodded in reply.
Barden stepped up behind Eagle and hiked his arms up. Jacob saw tears come to his father's eyes, then heard the cuffs fall away with a dull clink. His father brought his hands around in front of himself, rubbing the angry purple rings on his wrists. Jacob looked at him with concern.
"Are you okay?"
Eagle nodded.
"Okay, J.W.,"
Grossman was wheezing as they stood by one of the cars, but otherwise seemed to have recovered from the smoke inhalation.
"I'm going to read you your rights. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to an attorney. If you cannot afford an attorney, one will be provided for you."
J.W. looked up at Eagle and Jacob and the agents on the front deck. A flock of mergansers flew overhead, carping and squabbling. The sky was tea kettle blue. He could see Eagle's intense stare and feel his hatred radiating down at him. There was nothing he could say. Jacob toed the ground, no doubt feeling betrayed. He saw Flottebeau intercept Mona as she rushed down the road.
"What's wrong? Why are you arresting him?"
J.W. caught her eye and shook his head, attempting to convey that she should not say a thing. He saw the worry and confusion on her face, her feathers flashing in the morning sun.
"Just stay back, Mona,"
instructed Flottebeau, holding up his hands to bar her way.
"She is the local drunk," he said to Grossman.
She slapped him, prompting Flottebeau to grab her wrists.
"Settle down, Mona," he said,
and walked her backward. J.W. breathed heavily through his nose, but he said nothing and looked away. On the deck, Jacob was filled with an undirected rage. His heart told him something was wrong.
"Dad, it can't be."
Eagle raised a hand to silence him.
"You need to listen to me,"
Jacob said, trying again. But Eagle was focused on Richardson.
"It looks like we may have had a bad tip," said the agent. "I apologize."
Eagle nodded curtly, then watched as the agents and Deputy Barden began walking down to the cars.
"Dad,"
Jacob said, but Eagle cut him off again.
"Not now," he said.
Then he raised his voice, addressing the agents.
"If he was your tipster, he was probably going to plant that up here. He was trying to stop us."
Richardson stopped and turned back.
"That's interesting," he said. "Why do you say that?" "I'm opening a new tribal bank. You might have heard that it too was set on fire, but mine burned down. We were going ahead anyway. You think this is a coincidence? He came out here and got a job working for me. He was trying to destroy us."
Jacob was boiling inside. He had had enough.
"You're wrong,"
he yelled. He shoved his dad and stepped off the porch.
"Jacob!"
Eagle called out after him, but Jacob was heading down the hill. He needed to explain that J.W. had been out with them last night, and he needed to know what was really going on. He heard Grossman talking to J.W. as he opened the back door of the cruiser.
"You had it all, and you threw it away. And for what? A lousy roll of the dice?"
J.W. looked at him, but said nothing.
"Listen to me,"
Jacob said, racing up to the car.
"You're making a mistake. He was with us last night."
Grossman pointed at him.
"Back off,"
he called to Barden on his radio.
"Dan, can you get me a perimeter?"
10-4,
barked the radio, and Barden started walking down to the cars.
"Stay back or I'm going to f—"
He pointed at Jacob, then turned back to J.W. and put a hand on his shoulder.
"Watch your head," he said.
Jacob grabbed his arm.
"Just listen to me."
The blow came fast as Grossman spun and backhanded him hard. Jacob stumbled backward and fell onto the gravel. His knife flew out of his shirt pocket and sprung open.
"Weapon!"
yelled Grossman. Jacob scrambled to his feet, his face burning and his eyes blind with rage. He let out a roar of frustration and rushed Grossman. The blow had sound, a blast that hit Jacob in the chest and blew him backward with an otherworldly force. He stumbled, but stayed on his feet. He put a hand to his chest and felt a sticky warmth and an aching. His hands came away greasy red. Grossman's Ruger was smoking, and his chest was heaving. The painful ring of the shot filled his ears. He heard Eagle screaming and turned to see him running toward them. His Aunt Mona was crying and fighting to get out of Flottebeau's grasp, but she was making no sound at all.
"Damn you, Bob, he's just a kid,"
he heard J.W. yelling from somewhere.
"Call a f***ing ambulance."
It sounded like tinkles.
There was a rushing, and then he was in his dad's arms on the gravel. His lungs wouldn't lift. His heart pounded in his chest. He felt the warmth on his back, and it was somehow comforting. He let out an involuntary, burbly cough and felt the hot, coppery tin taste of blood in his mouth. He struggled to wipe his dry lips, and his hand came away with a pink-tinged froth.
"Jacob!"
His dad's face loomed before him, but the sound of his voice came from a mile away.
"Jacob, can you breathe?"
His dad pulled his own T-shirt off and pressed it into him. He shook his head. He tried to speak. His breath was weak and came bubbled and dark, and he struggled and grappled with an unspeakable urgency. His dad leaned down and put his ear close.
"I'm sorry," he managed to whisper.
And then the darkness rushed over him. J.W. rode in the back of Flatabow's car, destined for booking at the Bass County Government Center. A metallic, bitter taste filled his mouth, and his clothes and hair reeked of smoke. The blood from the gash over his swollen left eye had coagulated and was sealing his eyes shut. He could feel it, dry and scabby, on his cheek. The ambulance rushed and bumped on ahead of them on the dusty reservation road, leaving them in a cloud of dust so thick that Flatabow had to work his wipers.
"Can you turn on the emergency radio in case they say anything about him?" asked J.W.
"It is on," said Flatabow.
But there was only a dead silence, cut by periodic snippets of barely intelligible communication from other towns in the far twilight of radio range. They pulled out onto the highway, past Eagle's burned bank. He stared at the tag hanging and spinning from Flatabow's rearview mirror, a picture of four Indian chiefs in traditional headdresses. The caption read, "Homeland Security, fighting terrorism since 1492. The ambulance doors opened outward at North Lake Hospital's emergency entrance. The EMT, with Eagle and Jacob, hit a lever as he got out, and the gurney's legs scissored down onto the asphalt as the driver came around to take the other end. Jacob was unconscious, with an oxygen mask on his face and tubes running into his arms, but they had managed to restore a faint pulse that ran through him like a tiny serpent. Eagle followed as they wheeled the gurney toward the sliding doors, bags of plasma and saline swinging violently from the chrome rack. As they rushed down the wide hallway, Eagle became aware of a woman in hospital blues at his side, saying something about insurance. Two RNs ran up to join the gurney, and the EMTs filled them in as they hurried forward. Jacob was pale and pasty as lard.
"Sir?"
The woman's hand was on his arm. Eagle reached into his back pocket.
"Here's my wallet," he said, hurrying after the gurney. "It's all in there."
"Thank you, but I need you to come with me. You can't be with him in surgery anyway. Please, sir."
One of the RNs looked up at him and nodded, and in that moment, he felt Jacob's soul slipping away from him. The force of his will could not keep Jacob alive. He was in the hands of others who neither knew nor cared for him. As he stopped his forward rush, Eagle felt he was somehow finally giving up, and a sickening knot swelled in his heart as he watched the EMTs and the RNs wheel his son away around a corner.
"Sir?"
He turned to the woman and nodded, and she led him into a maze of glass-walled offices.
"You may want to wash up a bit," she said as they stepped into her office.
He suddenly realized that he was shirtless and streaked with his son's blood. She pushed a folded hospital gown at him and nodded toward a back corridor.
"Men's room is the second door on the left."
Eagle elbowed the door open and turned on the faucet, leaving sticky smudges on the handles. There was only one sink and toilet, and the door locked from the inside. He flipped the lock with his elbow, then went back to the sink and began washing the blood from his hands. Red rivers swirled around the white porcelain and ran down the drain. He pulled his hands out of the water and stared at the mirror.
"My God," he said. "What have I done?"
Part 5. The Payout. Chapter 35. In describing prison to Julie, J.W. observed that to Midwest Lutherans and hardened criminals alike, beauty has a palliative effect. In fact, he continued, beauty is as essential to the soul as air is to the body. The state prison in Stillwater was a post-Victorian example of this principle, and he described it in letters the way he once told her of the organelles of cells and the gill pouches of pharyngula's embryos, from whence fish and people both spring. Built in 1914 on the upper bluffs of the St. Croix River, which separates Minnesota from Wisconsin, the prison's tall brick facades had enormous windows and decorative flourishes that would have been deemed impractical and unnecessary today. Its population of murderers, thieves, and drug dealers spent their lives in a 20-acre square that was surrounded by guard towers and a high brick wall erected by the inmates themselves. There were buildings for the administration along the riverside of the square, a hospital, a counseling center, special disciplinary housing, otherwise known as solitary, three industrial manufacturing buildings, and three very large cell houses. The interior walls were finished with light blonde bricks, and the bars, gates, and railings were of blue-gray painted steel, a contrast that gave the building a light, airy feeling. The floors were made of a faintly pinkish stone that was polished to a reflective shine, and the corridor floors had a slight dip, worn thinner in the center by the daily traffic of 100 years. There were two main cell houses, each containing a detached, completely encased cell block, four tiers of blue-gray painted steel bars, cells, and catwalks that sailed like a battleship inside in its own private, bounded ocean, never touching the outside walls. The other house, D block, had five tiers. But what really characterized the prison was its enormous windows, which let in a wash of high, milky light of the kind that would be suitable for a painter's studio. This was especially true in the cell houses, whose exterior walls were three-quarters glass. In fair weather, these steel-framed window walls could be operated with levers to completely open the cell blocks to the breeze. The effect was of soaring freedom, which was sometimes a torture, but more often a balm. The catwalks of J.W.'s cell block had a catwalk that led along the cells like the gunwales of a battleship. During open hours, prisoners who were not at work stood on the walkways and leaned over the jointed pipe railings, talking or staring out the windows at the world beyond the walls. Otherwise, they congregated by the telephones and exercise equipment that stood under the vast window walls in the wide stone aisle of the first floor. Yet despite the beauty of the windows and of the pipe-jointed railings and the pink floors, the cells themselves were instruments of torture. Numbered with black stencils, each was a mere 6 feet wide by 9 deep, its front wall of bars the perfect receptacle for the guards' nightsticks. The cell offered neither space nor privacy, nor room to think too far beyond the mundane and the daily, and J.W. hadn't anticipated this closing of his mental world. Each cell held a single metal bunk rack hung from the wall with two solid steel brackets, a tiny sink, an attached metal desk with a built-in stainless stool, a bookcase, and a stainless toilet without seat or lid, which sat in full view of inmates and guards and of escorted visitors and administrators of both genders. All showers were on the first floor at the far ends of each cell house and afforded a similar lack of privacy.
You have been listening to Episode 21 of Sins of Our Fathers by Sean Lawrence Otto. The novel will be presented in a total of 23 episodes. If you miss any, you can catch up on our website, ktwh.org. Choose Programs and then Literally from the North Shore from the drop-down list. Please join us again next time for Episode 22 of Sins of Our Fathers, here on Literally from the North Shore.